From McMinnville, Oregon, this is Crisscrossing Science, the podcast that wants to clear the bad air. I'm Michael Crosser. Of course, you know Chad Tilburg, and today's title is The Malaria Vaccine. Hey, Chad.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm good. So we've had a recent episode about vaccines, I believe, and that got you all excited about malaria in particular. So why is malaria so amazing?
Yeah, the thing that's really interesting about this malaria vaccine story is that malaria is a bit of a different kind of disease organism than a lot of things that we're familiar with that have vaccines.
Okay.
And some of those differences, which we'll talk about a little bit, are what made it so challenging to actually come up with the vaccine. And I heard was listening to NPR maybe a month or so ago now, and there was a story about the widespread release of this new vaccine for malaria. And so I thought it would be interesting to explore in a little bit more detail what the vaccine is doing and what it's targeting about the disease organism. And to understand that, I think it is useful to go back and first understand what malaria is and how it's caused.
All right. So you say it's different from other diseases. So we're all familiar with some diseases that are caused by viruses, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
COVID, flu, things like that. I guess bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Like strep throat.
The brain swelling thing, whatever that is.
Oh, yeah. Meningitis.
Meningitis.
Yeah, like staph infections. And so, yeah, people are pretty familiar with viral and bacterial infections.
I've heard of fungus infections as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some yeast infections, some things like that.
Yeah, or like athlete's foot is a fungal infection.
There you go.
Uh-huh.
But by your reaction so far, we haven't hit upon what malaria is yet. So
that's right. The ones you've listed so far, so viruses are very different from anything that is cellular because, as we've talked about in the past, viruses are just a bit of DNA surrounded by some sort of a protein capsid. They don't have any sort of metabolism or cellular functionality on their own.
Mm.
And then the bacteria are very different from what we'll talk about today because while they are living cells, they are a very different kind of cell from our own cells and from the kind of cell that the organism that causes malaria is. For starters, their genome is organized differently in that it's not contained within a nucleus. While one of the first things you learn in a biology class is that cells like ours have a nucleus, and that's where...
In mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell.
That's right. That's exactly right. Those are the two salient features of a eukaryote. And the thing that we'll be talking about today is, in fact, a eukaryote. And so it is actually more similar to us cellularly than we are or it is to bacteria. And that's because as a eukaryote, it also, at least in its evolutionary history, had mitochondria, just like our cells have mitochondria for the exact same reason. The point being that these are cells that are more similar structurally and functionally to our own cells than our cells are to bacteria. And that similarity makes them a little bit more difficult to target. Yeah. So if we rewound the history of life on planet Earth back to well over a billion years ago, probably approaching 2 billion years ago,
okay,
we would see the very early glimmerings of the eukaryotic lineage, where we've got these cells that are actually a symbiotic interaction between what had been bacteria but are now mitochondria, and then the original host cell, which is now forming a nucleus around its genome. And so those early single-celled eukaryotes then diversified into a number of different really big groups. One of those groups went on to become our group, the animals and the fungi.
Mm-hmm.
Another one of those big groups went on to become the photosynthesizing things like plants. And then there are several big groups that remained single-celled that to this day did not become multicellular.
Slackers.
Yeah, right. And so within that lineage, a really weird thing happened along the way. I mentioned the lineage that ultimately gave rise to the plants. And mm-hmm. it turns out that along that plant lineage, there was these little single-celled red-colored algae. And at some point in the evolutionary history of what ultimately became things like the malaria parasite and a few other things, they underwent another round of endosymbiosis where they engulfed the red algae, thereby took on the photosynthetic ability of that red algae. Crazy. And so then this group gave rise to this really big, mostly unicellular group of organisms. There is a group of them that became multicelled, and you would know them as kelp. So like the seaweed that you see out at the coast and stuff, kind of laying on the sand every once in a while, you know, sometimes it's huge, right?
Yeah.
So that actually is an organism that photosynthesizes as a result of this capturing of that little single-celled red algae. All right. Simultaneously, there's this other lineage that was after that endosymbiotic event with the red algae, and it continued to diversify and evolve into new niches. And some of them retained that photosynthetic ability. We know them today as dinoflagellates, these little single-celled microscopic aquatic organisms that do photosynthesis and are a major component of the food webs in the world oceans.
Do they have big, nasty teeth? Hence the dino?
No, they don't have big, nasty teeth. They do have some like little rigid structural elements to them, but they're the kind of thing that occasionally, if they have like a big population explosion, they can call like toxic blooms or even red tides or things like that.
Oh, okay.
So you've ever heard of that, right? So that group of organisms, the dinoflagellates, retained their photosynthetic ability. Meanwhile, in their sister lineage, something happened that resulted in their chloroplast losing its photosynthetic functionality. Hmm. Not entirely clear what it was historically that caused that, or I mean, if it's known, it's not known to me. And this entire lineage took on a parasitic life cycle where they made their living by invading the cells of other organisms and making copies of themselves and then rupturing out and continuing the infection. It's oddly virus-like the way their life cycle proceeds within a host like that. Okay. And so this whole group of organisms to which the malaria parasite belongs is called the apicomplexans. And the reason I even bring up the name of it is because the name of the group is derived from this really interesting and important feature of the group that is part of its life cycle. And so at one end, at the apex of the cell, there's this little cluster of organelles that essentially form like a little drill that allows the parasitic cell to burrow its way through the membrane of host cells and gain entry. So that little complex of organelles that allows it to do that is the apical complex. And so then that is where the whole group gets their name from, the apicomplexans. So they all have this weird little feature. It's possibly the case that this little complex of organelles includes among them what had previously been a functional chloroplast, but now these no longer photosynthetic chloroplasts are doing something else, which is helping them burrow their way into the host cells. Okay, so that's the organism that we're dealing with and a little bit of its evolutionary history. It's not necessarily essential to know all of that, but I do really think it's interesting just to contemplate the fact that this parasite has in its evolutionary history ancestors who were photosynthetic. Anyway, that seems kind of cool and crazy.
They're basically plants gone bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So your point here, I think, is to say, essentially, malaria is very different from any other, you know, it's not a virus, it's not a fungus, it's not any animal or anything like
that. It's not a bacteria. And it has this really weird evolutionary history. Like, had you gone back in time and pointed to that lineage that is just sitting there doing photosynthesis and said, someday this thing is going to be a parasite of mammals, it'd be like, what are you talking about? It's just churning away doing a little photosynthesis here. So then that describes the entire group. So then the malaria parasite specifically, which is within this group, this is a parasite that has a complex life cycle. It has a whole bunch of different stages in its life cycle. And a good place to start is in the gut of a mosquito. And there's an infective stage that makes its way up to the salivary glands of a mosquito. And then when the mosquito takes a blood meal, one of the things mosquitoes do is they regurgitate a little bit of saliva into the puncture that they make. And that has anticoagulant properties, and then it helps them take a fast blood meal. And so
because if normally if you puncture some skin, then you have the platelets and other things that will stop it from bleeding pretty quickly.
That's right.
And so the mosquito is like, I'm eating here. And so it'll...
Right.
Its saliva is able to keep the blood flowing while it's still feeding.
That's right. A lot of blood parasites have independently evolved that ability.
Hmm.
And so anyway, this infective stage of the plasmodium called the sporozoite then sort of comes in with the saliva and makes its way through the circulatory system to the liver of the infected host.
Hmm.
And once it gets to the liver, then it unveils this little surface binding structure that allows it to bind to the surface proteins of the liver cells. Okay?
And only liver. It can't do that anywhere else in the body.
Right. If it did that elsewhere in the body, it would screw up its life cycle. And so this turns out to be really important for the development of the vaccine. This little binding mechanism is sort of, but my cartoon image of it is it's this big three-dimensional protein molecule that's sort of like curled in on itself.
Okay.
And then when it gets to the right place, it sort of opens up and then the sticky part of it is all exposed and then it sticks to the liver cell. And so if you were to reveal that too soon, then it might stick to the wrong kinds of cells elsewhere in the body. All right. So that helps it stick to the liver cells. And then it uses its apical complex to burrow its way into the liver cells. And then a single one of these sporozoites then will produce 30 to 40,000 of the next stage of the life cycle that then burst out of the liver cells and start circulating around in the blood.
Okay.
From a single sporozoite, you can get many tens of thousands of the next stage. And so you can imagine it doesn't take many sporozoites from the salivary glands of a mosquito to get a pretty large population of these things circulating throughout your blood.
Yeah.
So then the next stage starts to attack red blood cells. It uses that apical complex to burrow into red blood cells where it will produce not nearly as many copies of itself, but, you know, probably scores of copies of itself. And then those will burst out and infect more red blood cells and reproduce more and so on and so forth. And that then is when we start to see clinical symptoms. And it's usually a week to 2 weeks after the initial infection when that happens. Okay, so now we've got a person who's symptomatic with malaria. So let's complete the life cycle first before we talk about some of these other things. Within the red blood cells, most of the cells that are being replicated and released into the bloodstream are going to continue doing that, attacking more red blood cells and making more themselves.
Okay.
A few of them will be these precursor gamete cells. You know what gametes are?
Aren't those like reproductive cells?
That's right. So that's the generic term for egg and sperm.
Okay.
And so now we're sort of back on the sexual reproduction track here. And so these little gamete precursor cells, they're called gametocytes, are also circulating in the blood of an infected person.
Hmm.
And if a mosquito takes a blood meal from that infected person, those gametocytes get up into the gut of the mosquito with the blood meal.
Mm-hmm.
And inside the mosquito, the male and female gametocytes, that's where they complete the sexual reproductive cycle. They come together in fertilization to form a little zygote, which then immediately undergoes meiosis to produce more sporozoites in the gut of the mosquito. And then we're back around to the beginning.
This is a lot more complicated than other diseases that we've talked about.
Totally.
So let me see if I can repeat what you just said. So, you know, I'm kind of picturing like a tadpole or something like that.
Okay.
That undergoes some sort of metamorphosis, becomes a frog, and then does all these other things. So, it's doing all of that, but there are like three stages here. So it's much more complicated than any other example I can think of, you know, butterflies or anything like that, right? All right. So it starts out as one thing from the fly. It gets into the bloodstream. The only thing it can do at that point is get into the liver.
That's right.
Then it'll attach to your liver and then create sort of the like adult version of itself. And then those go out, they are now attaching themselves to your red blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, they're reproducing, but they're also creating egg and sperm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's blowing my mind that a single celled organism can have egg and sperm.
Don't think about it as like egg and sperm in the sort of animal reproduction sense. They don't really look like what you would recognize as, you know, like a big spherical egg and then a tiny little swimming sperm.
Okay. So a big swimming sperm and a tiny little egg.
No, they're they're just sort of like little oblong, squiggly little things.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And then those get sucked up by the fly, the mosquito, and then in the gut of the mosquito, then it can reproduce for real. And so presumably, is it combining an egg and a sperm from one host, or is it getting egg and sperm from, gets a blood meal from you, gets a blood meal from me, gets a blood meal from some other person, and is mixing all that together so that there's like more reproductive chances for change and so forth?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would guess it's probably the latter, especially in a population where malaria is very prevalent. A single mosquito might have taken blood meals from multiple people who were infected. And so then the mosquito in its gut would have a much larger pool of diverse gametes that can come together and fertilize each other.
Hmm.
I don't know that that has to be the case. It's probably possible that a mosquito could just take a blood meal from a single infected person and continue the cycle as well.
Hmm.
But you're totally right that you would expect more diversity in the plasmodium if it were arising from a more diverse assemblage of gametes.
Okay. So this is how they kind of go through their life cycle. And you said that it's at the point where they're getting your red blood cells that you start showing symptoms.
That's right. And so the bursting of these red blood cells, it doesn't just sort of happen in a dribble. There possibly is some sort of cue that causes them to rupture more or less synchronously. Mm. And so the infected person, they start feeling bad really rapidly.
Okay.
Because it starts leading to the production of all these cytokines really rapidly. So you start getting like really bad fevers and headaches and chills and vomiting and exhaustion. And so how severe those symptoms are is highly correlated with the parasite load. So more parasites equals a more serious case.
Hmm.
And that kind of a relationship helps us understand to some degree why it is that young children, like especially children under 5, are the population that is most negatively affected and has by far the highest mortality rate due to malaria, because their tiny little bodies, an equal number of parasites in a full-grown adult is a much smaller sort of per kilogram infection than that same number of parasites in a small little child.
Okay. Historically, how did people combat malaria then? What are ways to avoid getting it, to getting over the illness?
Well, let's talk about where this is first.
Okay.
Human populations affected by malaria are mostly in tropical regions throughout the globe, because the species of mosquito that vectors these things around are a tropical species of mosquito. And so it causes hundreds of thousands of infections and deaths per year. Most of those deaths, again, are young children. It's also, unfortunately, the case that many of the countries where malaria is prevalent also have underdeveloped or still developing economies, don't have very strong health infrastructures.
Mm.
And so it's kind of a double whammy of being in the right place for malaria, but not having the healthcare system to either prevent or mitigate it.
Mm.
And so some strategies are things like bed netting. And so if you can have insecticide resistant bed nets, then that can drastically reduce the incidence of mosquitoes landing on you while you're sleeping and taking a blood meal and transmitting it. So that's been really important to try to reduce. And it has the benefit of the fact that bed nets are pretty inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're the kind of thing that you can pass around and be helpful.
Is it best to always have a bed net so that you don't get infected in the first place? Or is it best to, as soon as you show symptoms, spend days or weeks within a bed net so that new mosquitoes don't come in and spread it out to other people?
My hunch is that it would be better to always use your bed net to try to prevent becoming infected at all. And in a lot of these places, the access to clinical help is hard to come by. And so that means that a lot of care happens at home, especially in isolated areas. And unfortunately, home care has a much higher mortality rate than if people are able to make it into a clinic in somewhere, because it is something that with supportive care, a person can pull through who might otherwise not have made it had they just stayed home. And of course, the availability of that kind of care differs a lot. For people such as myself who don't necessarily live in a malaria zone but might travel to a malaria zone, there are pills. So if you've ever traveled to the tropics, Africa or Central South America, your doctor might suggest to you that you take malaria pills. Or drink a lot of gin and tonic. Yeah, that's related. Do you know why that is?
There's something about the tonic, and I don't really understand it, but...
Yep, it's the quinine in the tonic that in high enough levels is somewhat similar to what the malaria pills do. There are a number of different formulations of malaria pills, and I think they're chemically related to quinine in some ways, and they don't prevent an infection, but what they do is they slow down the ability of the parasite to reproduce itself as much, and so it greatly reduces the risk of severe illness if you do become infected.
Okay.
So it's not preventative, but it is something that can change what could be a bad infection to just a less bad infection. Side effects, though, of some of these malaria pills, some people aren't affected negatively by them, but I've known people who, while taking them, have had really poor sleep and have had just really freaky, scary dreams. I don't know how common that is exactly, but I have encountered some people who've not responded well to the malaria pills, and so it's kind of not ideal. And
so do you normally take the malaria pills while you're there or when you get symptoms?
Yeah, so actually, for them to be effective, you have to start taking them before you travel so that you kind of build up a little bit of a tight of the chemical in your system and then continue taking them throughout. So that's a fairly common one. And then, of course, there's always programs to get more rapid treatment care to people who are infected. And you're not preventing the infection, but you are hopefully preventing more mortalities.
Okay.
And so a lot of these problems, though, could start to go away if there could be some sort of preventative vaccine so that people wouldn't get sick in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so people have been trying to develop a vaccine for many decades. And it's taken a really long time, especially when you think of how quickly we were able to develop a COVID vaccine. SARS-CoV-2 was completely unknown until 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And then by what, 2021 or 2022, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
We had functional, useful, effective vaccines. And so it's really amazing how fast it can go. And so I think it's interesting to contemplate, what is it about this situation that made this vaccine take decades and decades before it finally became available? And one of the first reasons is that it's really difficult to culture. And if you think about the life cycle that we talked about a little bit ago.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, you can imagine it takes two host organisms and it's got all of these different steps in it.
And so by culture, you mean, so oftentimes one way to make a vaccine would be to create a culture of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can either figure out its DNA or RNA or whatever, or you can, if you have enough of that disease, you can do the tests that you need to do for it.
That's right. You can easily grow up a large population of your disease organism and you can do all kinds of different things to them. And so there is no possibility of having like a petri plate with a huge culture of these that we can just like move some over to a new petri plate and grow up some more.
Right.
So that's complicated. The other part of it is it's this complex life cycle. And so each stage in the life cycle looks a little bit different to the immune system.
Right. And right? So you're saying like our bodies, for instance, make these T cells, and then the T cells are looking for the lock and key that we kind of talked about earlier. And so you're saying at each stage of life that the malaria has different locks and keys that would allow you to find it and target that.
That's right. It's almost like each new stage, it's wearing a completely different disguise. That's
sneaky. Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally sneaky. So that makes it complicated. And, you know, it means that if you don't get a real good knockdown of one of the stages, and it's really easy for enough to slip through, that you're on to the next stage. And these things, therefore, have led to a lack of sterile immunity against malaria in humans. So like, you know how for many diseases that we might get, like say chicken pox or certain strains of flu or colds or whatever, if you're vaccinated against it, you're immune to it. Or if you contract it naturally and then recover, you have immunity to it. And so if you're exposed again, you don't get it. That's not the case with malaria. And so that's why, like in these testimonials, these parents talking about how their kids were just getting it over and over and over again.
And it strikes me as, since you mentioned that there's some sort of a trigger, or it seems like there's a trigger that all at once, all the red blood cells burst. But this is sort of a sneak attack. And so every time it's a sneak attack.
Yeah, a sneak mass attack. Yeah. That's a good point. So another challenge is that there's lots of genetic variability for the potential vaccine targets. And you kind of got at this idea when you were talking about the possible recombination of different gametes coming together in the mosquitoes, and that reshuffles the deck of those antigen producing genes. And so in talking about vaccine development in the past, we've talked about how you want to have a stable target for the vaccine to attack. And in order for the vaccine to remain effective, that target needs to remain intact for as long as possible.
Right.
Some strains of malaria have a dormant stage where they just hang out inside the liver cells. And when they're doing that, they're inaccessible to the circulating immune system. And so they could just be hiding in the liver for a while. So that makes it a challenge. And then another thing that I think is worth mentioning is the lack of a financial incentive. If you think about where in the world this disease is most prevalent and where in the world most of the research and development in pharmaceuticals occurs. So a lot of the funding for the ultimately successful development of this vaccine was from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So shout out to Bill and Melinda Gates, longtime listeners of our podcast, I'm sure. And then GSK, a pharmaceutical company, had also been, to their credit, had also been doing a lot of research on it as well. And so it was the funding from private and corporate entities that finally pushed the ball to the top of the hill here.
So how does this vaccine actually work then?
Okay. So how it works is really interesting. So I mentioned earlier this little complex on the surface of the sporozoite, the stage that infects from the mosquito, that then sort of unfurls and grabs onto the liver cells.
Right.
That is called the circumsporozoite protein. Okay. So CSP, circumsporozoite protein. And so that is the structure that was decided it would probably be a pretty good target because it remains relatively stable. I talked about how a lot of the rest of the surface antigen proteins are pretty variable. This one remains relatively stable, and that makes a lot of sense because that is kind of like the lock and key thing for the liver cells. So that's part of it. And then they all have to have it in order to get into the liver cells. Originally, though, it was really hard to produce this full target molecule because it's large and it's complex, perhaps not very stable. And so it just made kind of a hard thing to target. And so research kind of stalled out after identifying this might be a good target, but we don't quite have the technology yet to do it in a large enough and stable enough way. And so this was like in the mid to late 80s.
Okay.
And then about at that time, some successful research making a hepatitis vaccine had been accomplished, and then a very successful hepatitis B vaccine was developed. And somebody had the genius idea that, okay, we have this hepatitis B vaccine that elicits a really strong immune system response and it's stable. Is there any way that we could take the relevant pieces of the circumsporozoite protein and combine it with those hepatitis antigens so that together it would be this stable immune system stimulating thing that is presenting the circumsporozoite protein instead of the hepatitis B protein? And so that's what they did, is they actually combined some of the relevant pieces from the hepatitis B vaccine with the relevant pieces of the target from that circumsporozoite protein of the malaria parasite. And that is now what the vaccine is made of. And importantly, the vaccine is stable enough that it can be transported around and actually administered.
Wow. And so this makes sense then that, as you said, it's stable, but it's also, this is before the malaria has a chance to really reproduce and really propagate all across the body.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So it prevents the malaria from getting to the blood infection stage or greatly reduces the severity of the blood infection stage. And so there are at least three countries in Africa now that have programs to be disseminating the vaccine nationwide.
Wow.
There are 20 to 30 other countries in malaria zones in Africa that are very interested in getting programs going in their populations.
Mm-hmm.
Millions of doses have been given, especially to kids. And I was looking at some of the data about how it had affected mortality and hospitalization, and those rates, especially in kids, are going down due to malaria as a result. So it's kind of a nice positive story to end the week on.
Yeah.
Or to begin the week with.
That's pretty cool. Well, thank you, Chad. You often bring in stories that are like, leave me depressed, but this is a feel good one.
Yeah. Well, good. Good.
This episode was recorded on the beautiful campus of Linfield University. Rudy Ortega wrote our theme music. If you like this episode or others like it, you should subscribe to the podcast. That way you'll download the latest episode as soon as it becomes available. While there, leave a comment and a rating, and that'll help other people find our podcast. If you have ideas for future episodes or questions that you're curious about, email us at crisscrossingsci@gmail.com. All one word, all lowercase. Or hit us up on social media. Until next time, thanks for listening.